Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And today, Cindy, today's a cheesy day. There's my cheesy overture to the program.
That's some pop humor there, I think. Mm-hmm. You get that naturally, honestly. That's
yeah,
nice.
Well, yeah. That's the way it goes. My 8-year-old's expert in those kinds of jokes. No, but let's talk cheese. People always have an interest in cheese. They want to know about making a cheese course. They want to know, where does it belong in a menu? How do you use cheese in a menu? Mm-hmm. When you're entertaining people, what's the right serving circumstance? What are the right wines for what kinds of cheeses, right? And then there is the calamitous mystery of cooking with cheese.
It's calamitous. I hope it's not.
That can lead to clotting. Please. And sticky and burnt crispy things.
Right, right. Well, yes. Right? Some nice crispy cheese on lasagna is good.
There you go.
But that's one of the few
there
spots.
There you go. You always bring the nice. And then also just, I mean, like, what cheese recipe is on your brain right now?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay, so let's spend some time on cheese.
Well, I have to say that one of our restaurants just brought back its cheese cart, and I feel like I did before COVID. When I saw that cheese cart come through the dining room, I literally almost got up and jumped out of my chair for joy. So there you go. It's back. Cheese is back.
Cheese carts are great fun.
It was hard to do with all the stuff going on.
There's not but so many times you find that stuff. That's largely a French and Northern Italian thing. You see it in some more parts of Europe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You will see it a bit in the British Isles.
Well, and typically, you know, you talk about when do you eat cheese. You typically in France, obviously, it's after the last savory course. The cheese cart would come by, or trolley, whatever you want to call it, and you would have an option. But that doesn't mean you wouldn't see cheese before the meal, you know, in other circumstances. But that's just what they do in restaurants.
Well, and I mean, and in Italy, you often see, depending upon the culture, and more often as you head south, you see some cheeses, what you would call table cheeses,
mm-hmm.
or I guess, you know, unkind word, but truly simple cheeses. In other words, not incredibly matured, not incredibly strong.
Fresh pieces.
As part of antipasti.
Right. Yeah, of course. So everything kind of has its place. I mean, do you want to start off with a poisse before your meal? I don't think so. You know, that's really
mild buffalo milk mozzarella.
Of course. Delicious. Perfect.
You know, as part of an antipasti with heirloom tomatoes.
Yeah. And I think
there's worse than that.
That's kind of how you know, just a simple way of looking at it is mild before the meal if you're going to have something ahead of time or, you know, and honestly, I think of a pecorino as a perfect, you know, mild Italian piece. Some of the fresh goats from France is a perfect first, you know, prior to eating food, cheese.
But like a young pecorino from Tuscany or from Lazio.
That would be great.
That's 3 months. Mm-hmm. Maybe 6 at most.
They
doesn't
can be
have
pretty
the
mild.
Intensity. Yeah.
Yeah, they can be pretty mild and pretty.
You get to like an 18-month and older piece, like from the Pecorino Sardo from Sardinia, or some of those pieces are super intense. And the salt really gets up there.
Yeah, salt for sure. Yeah, and, you know, I think as far as the cart goes or when you're serving cheese, you know, after dinner to your guests, you want to represent sort of the classes of cheeses, sort of, you know, maybe something that's, you want to hit the milks, so cow, sheep, and goat. And frankly, there are some cheeses that combine all three, which is fun, like Latour, right?
Yeah, so, Latour from Piemonte.
Yeah, but there are most often cheeses are just one milk, and so it's nice to represent them all, and to me, the categories of cheese.
So the different categories, so you have
washed rind pieces.
So washed rind pieces are those things that tend to have like an orangey outside, mm-hmm. maybe, or you can see
and they're
some,
moist on the outside,
right? And
they're softer pieces.
And the outside of those cheeses are more spicy, more intense when mm-hmm. you eat them.
And
so that's kind
itself,
of a choice that you make.
Yeah, the cheese itself is usually stronger. Poisse is an excellent example of a washed rind cheese, and if you've ever had it, you know it's, you know, really, really beautiful but strongly flavored.
So that's the kind of thing you'd want, like, in your lineup. It's probably the last one in your lineup.
Definitely.
Or last before.
Mm-hmm. a pressed piece with some age, probably, yeah. Or sheep's milk piece with age. Yeah, so you have the pressed pieces.
So what's a good example of that?
Tome de Pyrenees, cheeses that are consistently firm, that have a texture on the outside that usually you don't often eat. With a wash rind piece, the outside is so important to the beauty of the cheese, but with a pressed piece, you often don't eat the outside.
Yeah, like a Tome de Pyrenees that you often find commercially is a Petit mm-hmm. Basque. Mm-hmm. And Petit Basque is wax on the outside.
Yeah, that actually has wax, right.
And very mild, but good richness.
Mm-hmm. So pressed pieces are pieces that are firm pieces of cheese because they literally have been pressed. And then you have the soft pieces like a goat that can either be put into a mold or a light mold or can even go into a hoop or a basket for aging, which I'm always fascinated when I see a piece of cheese that's been in a basket because like Ticklemore has the most beautiful, and that's a pressed piece, but it has such a beautiful outside rind to it because of the markings from the basket.
You also see fresh goat that gets aged sometimes, mm-hmm. right, in longer cylinders that are kind of like the cheeses around a dowel.
Right. Yeah, that's super cool. Saint-Mars does that.
Saint-Mars de Touraine mm-hmm. is that.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the pyramids, like Valençay, yeah. also from Loire,
yeah.
does that.
And then they have naturally occurring mold or rind that develops over time. You know, maybe they come in at 3 weeks, and by week four, you start to see a change on the outside of the cheese, or some of those cheeses have ash. It can be vegetal ash on the outside of the cheese, which is an important part of the process. And then we have Grès de Vosges right now, which is gorgeous, and that's almost, I don't know what that shape would be called. It's almost like an oval, low, flat oval, flat top, flat bottom, but in an oval shape. Those are gorgeous. I love having the Grès de Vosges and the pyramid cheeses on the same cart because it looks so beautiful. And then you have the little rounds like Chabichou du Poitou, which are some of the, that's one of my favorite chefs ever. I mean, there's just so many beautiful pieces that you can get.
Well, it's interesting with French chev, the further north you go when you're up in the Loire, those cheeses are always more mineral, always more bright, and the acidity is higher. And when you go south, they get that fruity, like it almost take on like a banana mm-hmm. tone, you know? Mm-hmm. There's like more fat, And it has that, it's a different thing. It wants a different wine, which is interesting.
Well, and with goat, you always get a higher level of acidity. So, you know, and obviously a goat produces less milk than a cow. I think you can look at them and figure that out. And, so they just tend to be smaller pieces because they produce less milk and they are fresh pieces. But yeah, the acidity level can be high. And you tend to think of a cow's milk piece as being richer, a little less acidic, longer on the palate. Sheep's milk, even more so. You know, I think sheep's milk pieces are often almost caramel in tone and definitely more complex in flavor than a cow's milk piece, almost across the board. So that's why you want to have the three different types of milks. And there's more than three different ways of making the cheese, but the wash rind, the pressed piece, and the fresh pieces. I mean, it's...
Well, and I guess I think of blooming rinds is their own
group. Oh, right,
group.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. Brie de Meaux is the most famous of those.
And that's naturally occurring. The cheese blooms
that white,
like that.
White blooming mold on the outside.
It's so beautiful. I always, whenever I take cheese like that out of the package, I don't really want to touch it because I don't want to ruin any, you know, because if you put your fingers on there, that will, you know, will crush it in a little bit. And I just love that blooming rind. It's such a beautiful thing to look at.
Really nice Brie de Meaux. You cut into it,
mm-hmm.
and that downy white on the outside, and you have that very
oozy.
Like buttery
sexy,
yellow, like the
silky.
Best buttery yellow on the inside.
Definitely. I mean, I'm just sitting here smiling, just talking about cheese because I love it so much.
It has this mushroomy presence to it.
Yeah,
there's
it does.
A sweetness mm-hmm. and that at once.
It's an earthiness.
That's
exactly.
One of the reasons why that's one of the great cheeses to pair with wine.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and you know, some of the English cheddars are just so brilliant, you know, compared to what, you know, when we grew
up. So those are press pieces.
Those are huge. Like, I have a 55-pound wheel of
good
cheddar.
Good for you.
Yeah, and of cheddar in my walk-in that I just received from Neil's Yard. And I'm so excited to get into that. I buy it because I know we will use it a lot with our pastas and things and different dishes that we use as we come into the fall, which we're about to hit. So I'm super excited to have that piece of cheese. And I age my cheeses as well. I mean, my purveyors age them beautifully, but I find some of them need to be aged by me as well. So that's part of my thought process when I'm buying.
How about blues?
So
to me, that's the
another,
other group. It's a wild card group.
It is. Well,
you're short on the groups.
Is it naturally occurring mold? Is it injected with mold? Is it because it was in a cave that's fit like Roquefort that's famous for the caves?
So what are examples of each type of blue?
So Stilton is, I mean, to me, the king of blue cheese. I mean, I kind of hate to say it that way, but it's like Stilton is made still the way it's always been made. And it's just so a little bit more creamy. It's not a dry blue. It's not like soft like a brie or something. But I mean, it does have a creaminess to its texture. It doesn't totally crumble. It holds together and it has a richness on the palate. And it makes the blue aspect of it seem more married together with the rest of the cheese. It doesn't feel so shocking to have that bite of intense blue.
It's not as edgy.
Vein. Right. And, you know, that's just such a famous, gorgeous piece of blue and something that, you know, often was served around Christmas time. And, you know, it's a big piece. They weigh about 15 pounds consistently. So they're just, it's an impressive piece of cheese. If you can buy a whole wheel, that's an awful lot of cheese for somebody to have at their house. But you can certainly buy pieces of Stilton. But if you are having a big holiday and you know you're just kind of like 20, 30 people over, why not buy the whole wheel? And and Stickleton is produced by a couple of other fellows.
And Stickleton's another blue.
And yes, Stickleton is very similar to Stilton. Comes from a similar region and a similar process, but it's just a little bit different. It's kind of fun. If you do see a piece of Stickleton and you're a Stilton fan, you might want to try it because it's right now, especially the piece I just broke into a piece, and it's really remarkable. And then you have things like Forme d'Humbert, which is a French blue, versus we were just talking about pieces from Great Britain.
Forme d'Humbert is cow's milk, no?
It is, and it's definitely softer, definitely creamier. It's just a milder piece of blue. It's good for, you know, if you're doing blue cheese stuffed olives, I like to use Forme d'Humbert.
Oh, it's cocktail time. I like that.
obviously you can just eat it. It also makes, like if you're doing a salad, Forme d'Humbert is nice too. It's not as expensive as, say, a Stickleton or a Stilton. So it is a more affordable piece of blue and, you know, great for a salad, really, because of its texture.
Melt on your burger.
Right. And I think those are three excellent examples of blue. We also have Beanley and Harborne that we use that come from Great Britain. And those pieces are very different.
Beanley is marvelous.
Oh, I love Beanley so much. If you see that somewhere, please buy it and try it. It's almost all white rather than, like, if you look at a Stilton, you see a really sort of... I don't know what to say, just a darker, creamy looking texture.
It's very veined.
It's very veined. And the Beanley is really just like a big white, I think they weigh about 7 to 8 pounds, and it has a little bit of veining, but those are sheep's milk pieces, and oh my gosh, you can tell it was made with sheep's milk.
The texture is spectacular.
Oh my goodness, they're just gorgeous. And the moment you release it from its packaging and oxygen starts to hit that cheese, it starts to literally not bloom like a blooming rind, but it actually starts to bloom, and you can see the color of the veins start to
veins,
hit.
The veins come up with the oxygen. Yeah.
And it's really quite exciting to see. And it's also a piece of cheese that will last for a while. In other words, because of its moisture content, the way that it's built, if you keep it wrapped properly in your refrigerator, you know, you don't have to like buy it and eat it. You can keep it for a week or something once you open the packaging, as long as you rewrap it correctly.
I'm going to throw one very scary blue in on you.
Okay.
It's the one that...
Cabrales.
Cabrales.
That's scary to me.
Awesome.
I don't like Cabrales.
Young, fresh Cabrales is awesome.
Okay.
You know, from Asturias and the north of Spain.
Oh, it's a beautiful cheese, but it's a little too strong for me.
The Spanish blue, that's a cow's milk and just delicious. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, like just eat seafood along that coast, and then a fat piece of cabrales, a bunch of figs.
That's nice.
You know, that's a happy time right there.
So what was your scary blue?
Valdeón.
Oh, okay, yes, that is pretty scary.
From Estremadura.
And actually, I'm thinking of Valdeón and not Cabrales, now that you say that. Yes.
That's the one that...
Valdeón comes in, like, it's so strong, it comes wrapped in foil.
Yeah, there is happiness there, but there is some violence also.
It might, like, eat you, that cheese is so high in acidity. Yeah, it's literally right. That is what I'm thinking of. I'm sorry, not Cabrales. It is Valdeón.
Cabrales, I'm like, what do you have against Cabrales?
Yeah, it's not Cabrales.
Cabrales
anyway,
is lovely and tender and so, affectionate, you know?
Yes, so Valdeón is what milk?
Valdeón is sheep.
Sheep's milk, yeah. Well, if you like Epoisse, you'll like Valdeón. Tony loves Epoisse. I mean, I remember the first time.
I love Epoisse, but I don't love it as much as a similar cheese from the same region, L'Ami de Chambertin.
Oh, we've been serving that. That has been going out the door like hotcakes.
More spicy. That's even more spicy.
Yeah. L'Ami de Chambertin is a gorgeous cheese. Actually, I think I like it better than Epoisse too, but they're both very, very good cheeses.
The other mild washed milk from that area, Citeaux. Citeaux. That's hard to get in the States, but that's a lovely one. All of those cheeses, if you have white Burgundy, top flight Chardonnay, really good Pinot, but you need acidity in those wines to match them. They do incredibly well with those cheeses. So, Cindy, we spent some time on cheese types. I think we got all the big categories and some examples. When we come back, let's spend some time on wines that make sense with those types and some of those examples, and also how to actually serve a cheese plate and have it as its most attractive. On Formidable Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR. Welcome back to Formidable Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we're talking all about cheese today. Yes. We spent time in the first segment on types of different kinds of cheese. And people always have an interest in cheese plate or cheese for snacking. We're largely talking about cheese for after a meal as a last savory thing, you know. Mm-hmm. When you think about it logically, cheese is the thing with the flavor and honestly the fat and the satisfaction that follows. Like when I was in France in May, those guys were laughing because at the end of a meal, like, I don't really want to sweet as much as I want to save the last little bit of whatever the most special wine was. I want a little bit of just plain baguette, and I want one piece, one slice of something that's dead on for that. And that little moment, that like 3 minutes of bliss, that's perfect for me.
I agree with you. I'd much rather have cheese and pastry any day. And
don't tell any pastry chefs. If you listen to this, it's a big secret.
But yeah, the idea too with that being final is that you always say what about picking cheese and wine together at the end of the meal? Not if you have to finish something, but if you're getting a new bottle, you always say not necessarily red, right?
Well, exactly.
Because a lot of people think, oh, we have to get red wine now, and it's like you always say not so. So tell us.
You talk about goat. People love goat cheese. If it's from the north, those with the higher acidity. That can work for red. That can work for Rhone Valley reds. It can also work for some, like, riper Syrah, but not too tannic. The tannins don't help you, that sort of chalky business on the sides of your mouth. They don't do you a lot of good with cheese.
Right, okay.
What you want is that punch of fruit, that focus, that acid. And there's also, like, an earth connection there. There's a mineral connection.
Sure.
You know, that has a lot to do with place.
So we were talking on one of the shows recently about blue, and I was drinking a little bit of champagne that I had, and I just absolutely hated it with the blue. So
the blue's too much.
The blue's
too much. I mean, that
it blows it away.
The classic blue, all-time classic blue pairing is Roquefort, the strong sheep's milk from Languedoc. Mm-hmm. Right? And Sauternes. And Sauternes, think about it. It's going to take on almost anything. The sugar is high. The acid is high. It has really good intensity, really good phenolics, that density of material.
Well, and don't you like, you know, I like to eat just cheese, but a lot of people like to have dried fruit with cheese. I mean, honestly, I think of a sauterne as like a dried fruit in a way,
which, in a way, it is,
because the fruit on the vine is...
But it will have that mineral content. And sauterne also usually is aged in oak, so it has a vanilla tone to it.
Okay.
So you got to think about that.
Yeah.
Like if it was, if you try to put that with Valdejon, which has that like certain funkiness that some cheese milk can.
Yeah.
That's too much for the sauterne even.
Okay. So what would you, what else could you put with a blue besides the sauterne?
Depends upon the blue for sure.
Okay.
For example, the Beanley that you love so much, because the blue vein is pretty mild in that, it's not as aggressive. And the fat is quite good in that.
Yeah, yes.
A young Rhone Valley wine, like a Châteauneuf du Pape from a really ripe year.
Good. Okay.
That can do very well with that.
So that's a wait, a red or a white?
That's a red.
A red.
That's
okay.
A red.
Okay.
You can certainly have some white with that. You want a white that was off dry. Mm-hmm. There's a white that you rarely see in the States from the Pyrenees called Jurançon.
Oh, yeah.
And that
okay.
Those sweeter Jurançon, like from Clos Orjula, that is really sweet but has really good acid and big personality. That can take that on. The biggest trick you were talking about, that people want to have red wine. And my next thing, I want to have red wine. It's hard to do. You have to have the right cheese for it. And that's not the cheese plate. People love to put cheese plates out with, you know, almonds and honey and jam and dried fruit and all this kind of business. That is its own thought. That isn't necessarily associated. The more that you do that garnishing to it, the less it has to do with the wine you're going to serve with it.
Okay. Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Of course it does. Sure.
It kind of is cross purposes.
Which is why I just like cheese. Yeah. I mean, I like a little simple toast point very much because it kind of prepares you for the next cheese. I like to eat the cheese, you know, with a knife and a fork.
Yeah, I don't even want toast point. You know me, I just want...
You like fresh bread.
Just a little bread crust.
A little baguette
or
something.
Just a little bread crust.
Yeah, a lot of people do too. We get asked often for just slices, and I'm happy to do that. We almost
good for them. They're the good guys.
So, Tony, you were saying all those things are at cross purposes with the wine. So tell me, what do you mean when you're saying that?
Well, it depends. Mm-hmm. First question is, are you going to consume wine with cheese? If you are not, then absolutely you should have that slice of Brie de Meaux with slices of apple and maybe some walnuts on the plate and little buttery toast. It's like, that's awesome. And that's terrific, you know? And maybe you're having that with cider or something, or like whatever you might want to do.
Right, but if you're having wine.
If you're having wine, you have to think about what are the things that are going to interact with the wine as well as the cheese. If you have dried fruit that has sugar, it's going to throw off your dry wine.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
That's one.
All right.
If you have, let's say it's an almond or a walnut, if you bite into that, that's bitter, isn't it? That's going to amplify that in the wine. Those things are both going to like throw off the balance of the wine with the cheese, as well as make the wine less attractive.
So basically, you've just introduced a strong flavor other than the cheese, and it's going to compete. Yeah, that makes sense.
It's putting a little bit of rock and roll guitar into the middle of a beautiful Spanish guitar ballad.
Yeah.
You know, I love rock and roll guitar, but that's a different thing.
Right, I get it. Okay.
So.
We talked about blues.
Pressed milk is tricky.
Okay.
Pressed milk is tricky. Just think about it. So what are the, like Gouda in the States a lot of times, right? Mm-hmm. That's strong flavored, intense, sharp.
Fatty.
Typically fatty. And you think, well, what does that want? Well, one, honestly, that's not a bad beer match.
I knew you were going to say that.
Because it just is.
That's one, nothing wrong with it. That's
two,
not,
if you want wine for it, I would have something a little bit off dry with really good acidity. I mean, I would look to Alsace.
Yeah, that sounds good.
You know, I would look to Alsace also has enough alcohol to carry that. There are Germans that are excellent with cheese, like a Spätlese or an Auslese with the German cheese Campazola can be terrific. And the Campazola you can find in the store.
Yeah.
It's tasty. It's not a high fat, you know, blue. It's mild. That's an easy, you want a little happy, happy, you know, cheese toasty, put a little Campazola on a toast.
Well, Okay, I get it. So
and have that little bit sweet, you know, German wine with it.
What about some of the Waschwein pieces? Like, you know, maybe we often serve Gubin or Ardrahan, and these are cow's milk pieces that are Waschwein that are, I mean, they're so long on the palate, so fascinating.
So the ones like Gubin is not as strong as Ardrahan, right? Gubin, you could even have champagne with Gubin.
I can see
like a Pinot-based champagne,
fun.
You know?
I love that. All right.
Maybe from the village of Bouzy or Ambonnet or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But one of those like plump, you know, red-fruited mm-hmm. champagne, okay. that can work for that.
Ardrahan needs a glass of scotch.
Ardrahan, I would not mind a little malt whiskey with, frankly.
All right.
Especially the stronger ones.
Yeah, that is a serious cheese.
And there are some British Isles cheeses like Doddington that...
Oof.
That I love so much.
Yeah, that's no longer available.
No, but
unfortunately,
if you go to right at the Scots border where the creamery is,
well, then you can get it.
Like I did a couple of years ago.
Well, yeah, we can't get it here, but
I got not only Doddington cheese.
Oof. Wow, nice.
And a little pub called the Red Lion, right? That had solid cooking.
Fun.
Very solid cooking, but I got a very nice glass of malt whiskey. When I say glass of malt whiskey. I mean, the nightcap that puts you to bed
for
a couple of days. Yeah,
a tumbler, 8 ounces.
Perhaps a tumbler, a digestive tumbler of a Lowland
nice.
Malt.
Hey, it's yeah. vacation.
It was vacation after about 20 minutes. but that was great to have. But Doddington's a little bit like a cross between a cheddar and a Parmigiano. And so you have that crystalline... quality.
Yeah.
And you have that bit of like sweet cave thing that good cheddar can have.
Yeah, definitely caramel on the finish as well.
And that was honestly nice with the whiskey.
And that's such a hard cheese. I mean, it's almost like a hard cheese, really, in texture. That's the cheese is hard to cut.
The press pieces you were talking about initially, things like the Tome de Pyrenees, like Petit Basque.
Tome de Brebis.
Or super popular in the States, Manchego.
Mm-hmm.
At all different ages, mm-hmm. right? Like a very young Manchego and a fruity young red wine, fine. But honestly, it's white wine that you want for those kinds of pieces for the most part.
Yeah, I can totally see that.
Just something to clean it up, bounce a little bit of fruit off of it, and that works well. Let's talk a few minutes about the care of cheese and how cheese is presented to best advantage.
Yeah.
You know, that... You mentioned temperature, and temperature is a big thing. You don't want things cold out of the fridge.
No.
And things will always dry some in the fridge.
Yes.
You have to be aware of that.
Yes, depending on what's going on in your refrigerator, absolutely. And your home refrigerator is pretty humidity controlled. So.
But you also don't want it to be too warm.
Yeah, you can't have it sit out on a hot summer day. That's just...
And you can't have it out on this... Like, people will have something out, and there's, like, sun hitting the coffee table.
No
or what,
way.
Like, You can't do that.
You want it to be at our room temperature, you know.
Room or a little cooler.
Yeah, yeah.
Like if you have, ideally, like at home, I have a piece of marble.
Mm-hmm.
If we put cheese out, a couple of pieces, I'll put that in the fridge, bring that out, put the cheese on that like 40 minutes ahead. They'll come up in temperature and stay a little cool because the marble will hang on to the temperature.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps.
Yeah. Yeah. You just want it at room temperature, period. I mean, you know, as long as your room isn't 90 degrees. I don't know anybody that lives that way.
Well, you keep your room kind of cool, so that's probably true.
Yeah. Well, I mean, definitely I'm with you. It can be cool. You certainly don't want it to be in a hot environment. As far as storing cheese, if you can buy cheese paper, really, truly, that's the best thing, especially for a Waschwein piece. They just get funky. They're already funky.
They do not like plastic wrap
at all. No. And you really can't wrap them in a foil either. So if you can't find cheese paper, then just use wax paper is great. But unfortunately, the things with wax paper is that it doesn't cling. So you really have to, like, it's a big piece. You fold it, you know, like they do would like well, wrapping up your meat or something at market. You want to really...
Parchment paper can work.
Yeah, both of those. Either one with wax paper or parchment paper. Just fold it around the piece and wrap it up nicely because air is the enemy. You just don't... Yeah, plastic wrap is the worst, really, truly. I mean, obviously, we have to wrap it in plastic most of the time, but if you can have, you know, some of those especially Waschwein pieces. Well, and also the drier pieces are going to dry out if they're not in plastic or, you know, really saved from the air. But that's the biggest thing. The other thing, too, is that some of the pieces, even some of the goat cheeses, if I bring them bring them home from the market and I put it in my refrigerator, and I open my refrigerator like an hour later. I'm like, oh, do I really want that smell in there with all the rest of my food? I will then take it from the wax paper or parchment paper cover wrapping, leave it in that, and then put it in a plastic baggie. And that allows it still to breathe and get some air, but it's not affecting everything else in your refrigerator, especially if you have like pastry or something in your refrigerator. You sure don't want that, you know, angel food cake or, you know, a little custard tart,
little
or something
goat's cheese,
to smell
tart.
Like. So, yeah, so often, and I'll do that with cured and smoked meats too. Often when I bring them home, I'll just put them in one more baggie that's sealed so that you're not, and then if you have a drawer, it helps too. But yeah, that's it. You know, when it's sitting out, obviously you want to make sure that it's somehow covered if when it's not attended to, not being used, whether it's one of those little baskety, you know, sort of screen-like things. That's nice. It keeps everything away from it, your pets, hands, little hands, whatever. And it just protects the cheese a little bit, so that's nice.
You mean like one of the screen domes
those are nice to have. And, you know, you said marble to serve it. I like wooden pieces as well. There are plenty of beautiful cutting boards and things. And the nice thing about...
Well, the marble is just to hold the temperature.
Right. And the problem with marble is it's going to annihilate your knife edge. So if you're using a real knife on marble, you really don't want to do that. If you're using a steak knife and a fork, which I'll often use at home, if it's not a super hard piece of cheese, if it's a salt like a goat or something, you can certainly, you know, everybody can help themselves to that with like your home steak knife, and that won't be affected by a marble piece as readily as a beautiful chef's knife or something.
Let me throw one last little, like, perfect pairing thing in from my experience. Parmigiano Reggiano, which is pretty ubiquitously available, and by the way, does not like to be in refrigeration for long at all. It changes very quickly. It dries out very quick. You think, oh, this cheese is pretty dry to begin with, but it just, like, it saps life from it. Mm-hmm. When you buy a piece, the plastic is not an issue so much for that. I'll often, if I get a piece and I take it home, I'll put it in one of those like big, like to-go quart jars or something, just like wrapped up in paper, and it's happy with that. But only for so long, because it dries out really quickly.
And the pairing?
The pairing is Lambrusco.
Oh.
So, and it's not like, you know, you're swinging dad's where you need a Lambrusco, right? But there are lots and lots of very good lower alcohol red wine that have a little sweetness and have really good acidity from that same area of Italy, from Modena, from nearby Parma, nearby some parts of Lombardia, some parts of the Veneto, that you see a lot of these. And, oh, my goodness, it is like shocking how nice...
Okay, good.
Shocking how nice it is
Lambrusco.
Together.
All right.
It's an exact, and there are other wines like an Otro Pavese, and they're more obscure names, but that's Lambrusco, or wines like Lambrusco with Parmigiano is a very perfect pairing.
Great.
We come back on Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. We've got more cheese for you on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
Today it's all about cheese. We spent time on all different categories of cheese.
Yes.
Pairing wine with cheese. Mm-hmm. Some guidelines on serving cheese.
A little bit of storage.
And storage.
Yeah.
Which is a big deal.
Yes.
And now...
Portioning the cheese.
Portioning cheese.
A little toast point action.
Cooking with cheese, yeah. Well, but first and foremost, you better nail... Like, fresh baguette is fresh baguette. Go get a fresh baguette. If you can make one, good for you. The other alternative is to make toast points. And so...
And the beauty of making a toast point is the butter. So you want a good butter for this one. And you want a pastry brush and a lot of butter.
I think that's your epitaph.
I cannot tell.
Beauty is in the butter.
That will be my epitaph. And I will be buried with my peppermill, my sous chef told me many, many years ago, because it's the best peppermill in the world, and I still have it 20-some years later. Anyway, so making toast points, you want them to be pretty pretty thin, not paper thin, of course. That's too thin, but pretty thin. And cut them consistently because you're going to put them on a sheet pan and you want them to bake consistently. You don't want some to get dark and some to be light. Brush them liberally with butter. So you melt the butter. Get your pastry brush out, have some fun, just start painting the little bread with the butter. If you just, you know, this is something I have to tell every single new cook that works on my Gramache station, and then I have to tell them like five more times because no one ever puts enough butter on there. So they're like, I'm like, nope, go back. And so, and they work on the table across from me. Yeah, I'm like, no, let me show you again. So yeah, be nice with it. I bake them at 325 degrees in a convected oven. If you don't have that, it'll just take a little bit longer. And you want them to be golden, you know, not dark, because it'll taste a little burned.
But just until they take a little color.
Yeah, you want them to be crisp, honestly. Your goal is crisp and golden. If they're soft, they're no fun. You do want them to be crunchy. That's it. End of story. You know, we use our raisin fennel bread from the day before, which is perfect for toast points and it's delicious. And then we also use our baguette. So we have something that's very neutral and then we have something that has a little bit of flavor to it if the guest is happy for that.
So let's talk a few minutes about portioning cheese, because cheese comes in all of these different cute shapes that you're talking about. Right, in pyramids and in ovals and in big rounds and in giant wheels that are, you know, a foot and a half tall and all this kind of business.
Well, we talked a little bit, yes, of course, all different shapes and sizes and hardness and softness. So we talked a little bit about, you know, you could even use a fork and a steak knife that's nice and sharp from your house. You can use a chef's knife. But we should also talk about the fact that there is a cheese knife that has holes in the blade. And I will tell you that thing is that is the key to really being successful with a softer cheese. Any cheese is going to sort of suck itself onto the blade of your knife.
So when you say holes in the blade, it looks like it's when you look at it straight on, it looks like any knife. It's just narrow.
And has a curved
when you
blade.
Look at it from the side, mm-hmm. it has big slots.
Yeah, big pieces.
Frankly,
missing.
That make it much more aerodynamic moving through the cheese.
Right.
There's much less friction.
Yeah. I strongly suggest getting that. Now, they're not very long. That's the only thing. I wish somebody would make one that's like 8 to 10 inches. They're usually like 4. They're pretty small knives, unfortunately. So they only work on certain sized cheeses. So you also need a big knife. But your goal with any cheese, whatever shape it is to go from the center to the outside. You want the point of your knife to be at the center of the cheese because you want to enjoy as much of the interior as the rind. So that's just your goal. That's your rule of thumb.
Well,
end
of
story.
If it's a huge cheese, it can't be that way.
If you step it, it can. So, you know, if you, which is a little dangerous for folks at home. I don't really like the idea of people doing that at home. But if you're good with a knife, you can step it, which means you cut out the portion on the top that you want for yourself. Let's say you're doing one portion. You cut a triangle out on the top of a piece of Stilton, for example, which is a big piece of cheese.
You're building a circular staircase by removing one piece of cheese after
at a
the
time.
Other.
Right. So
as
then
you go down.
And then you slide your knife straight in from the side to the center of the cheese, flat, which that's what makes me nervous. If you don't know how to use a knife, you shouldn't do it. But if you do, go for it, because that's the best way. Or traditional with Stilton, there are still out there in some of the old shops, is the, I don't know what you call it. It's almost like a spoon. Yeah. It's more like a plug shape, but yeah, a Stilton spoon. I have one actually made by local Baltimore silver makers, and it's quite old and it's beautiful. So you can, and that's nice for your house. I mean, I can't really use it at the restaurant. It's not appropriate, but for your home, it's gorgeous. And then people can help themselves easily to a piece of, you know, and you just, again, you go in from the side straight across the top of the cheese. You're not going down, you're going across the top. But yeah, with most cheeses, it's just cut out a triangle, almost all of them, or a thin slice. But I'll say what I said on that recent show, we were talking about cheese. Honestly, the more you cut the pieces for the guests, the more they're going to eat and enjoy. If you make them do it, they're just
if not. If you make it just...
Yeah,
if,
make
if
it easy for them.
If it's a pickup item or if it's super easy, then mm-hmm. great.
Or if it's something that's crumbly, go ahead and put it on toast points for them and let them just pick up the toast point ready to go. That's really the answer to that.
It's funny. The first time I saw whole wheels of Parmigiano, like whole wheels of Gruyere or Comté, these gigantic pieces that are like, you know, what, you know, 20 kilos.
Oh, they're huge.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you have to deal with them. They like get delivered and you have to deal with them. Cheese wires are fine. They don't work on something like that. remember grabbing the double hand, having to show someone the first time how to handle the double-handled cheese knife. It looks like a, you know,
a rocking blade.
Yeah, a rocking blade
with
that you
two.
Literally, yep. You know, you're like seesaw back and forth to get through the cheese.
You can also use tools.
And you work hard.
Oh, definitely.
To do that.
Definitely. You can also use tools to just kind of chisel out pieces of cheese as well, of the Reggiano, a hard piece like that.
Yeah.
So you can go either way. Actually, I have a wire, and oh my gosh, that's the best thing if you want to do slices of goat. Like when we do goat cheese.
The more delicate cheeses?
Yeah. That's what that's perfect for. I don't know that I would have that when I had guests around, but if you're cooking with cheese, or, you know, and in this case, that's what I'm doing. I make a slice of goat, dip it in butter, into light breadcrumb, a little bit of salt and pepper, and then we bake it in the oven and serve it on a green salad, which is so French. You know, those little cheese wires are perfect for that. But don't put a wire out for, again,
no,
if there's shit gets around or...
Give people cocktails and give them a garrote is not a good idea for your party.
No, so you can use it on your own when you're not drinking by yourself in the kitchen. But cooking cheese, let's talk about it. We started.
We did. So you posted a photograph recently on Instagram of raclette. So who doesn't like melted cheese?
Oh, I don't. No one. Everyone loves.
And that's the ultimate, right?
Oh, my gosh. I will never forget eating that. That we were in Cogne, Italy, and...
All the way up in the Valle d'Aosta in the northwest, right near the Gran Paradiso and the Mont Blanc, which are the two... highest peaks in the Alps with the Matterhorn.
If you can ever go there, you need to go there.
Yeah, beautiful place, beautiful valley, famous for a couple of cheeses. Mm-hmm. But the whole, you know, on the other side of that mountain are all the great cheeses of...
Switzerland, you know, right? Is it Switzerland?
Well, north is Switzerland, west is France.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah,
all
right.
of the great Alpine cheeses are
oh,
right there.
Gosh.
And raclette being one of those.
And, you know, it's funny because when we sat down, and here you are in this restaurant that's just everything you want it to be. I mean, it looks like this old world, you know, the lady has on the little outfit with the little apron and, you know, the old wood carvings on the wall, and everything's just so, and the view of the mountains, you're sitting there looking at one of the most beautiful mountain peaks in the world and, you know, just in this lovely little restaurant. But the device they use to melt the cheese is, I don't even know how to describe it. What would you say, Tony? It's like almost like a toaster, but it's two plates.
It's sort of like a cross between a toaster and a curling iron.
It's two metal plates in a triangle, and the cheese is kind of speared in you know, underneath that, which is, of course, it's weird because they bring it to the table and they plug it in.
They plug it in.
You feel like you've been transported back to the 1950s
or something. It just drips onto the plate.
It's so awesome. Oh, my gosh.
And they bring a basket of... these beautiful potatoes from the valley.
So good.
You know, little guys like fingerlings.
Yeah, little white ones, but they're naturally sweet.
Steamed.
Yeah.
And might have been boiled, but it seemed like they were just steamed.
Yeah, I think they were steamed.
And in a little basket wrapped up in linens.
Local linens.
Yeah, and you pull one of those guys out, and you cut it on your plate, and you dip it in the raclette.
I just want to do it so much
it is
right
so,
now.
It's potatoes and it's cheese fries.
Yeah,
it is the most sophisticated, amazing cheese fries.
Oh,
you know, and you drink a glass of Tourette's or something, you know, or Sauvignon or one of the excellent Chardonnays from one of the producers there. That's
like
happy
you've
stuff.
Literally gone to heaven. It's like the greatest thing.
And cheese fry heaven.
Yeah, and then like we had the braciola, right? Is that what the meat was? It was some sort of cured...
It's not braciola.
Okay.
It is a dried beef. It is dried beef that they do in that valley.
Okay.
Which does not have
so
a DO. But yeah, they make their own.
It doesn't have a what? A designation.
Denominazione originale.
Okay, got it. Yeah, that meat was so good. And it was really important kind of to enjoy it because, I mean, you know, as wonderful as the cheese is.
From time to time, you have a little bit of air-dried beef.
You need to have something other than the, amazingly rich cheese that's melting and you just want to eat like pounds of it, but you can't. So it's nice to have the dried meat.
You can definitely eat some of it.
What a great thing. And that pasta, that cheese pasta, is it tubetti? It's the little pasta with the local sausage and the cheese. It's like almost like a not a cheddar, but almost like an orange melting cheese on that pasta. And, oh, that's one of the best pastas I've ever had in my life.
Cheese and cheese sauce are complicated things for pasta.
They are.
People do all kinds of things that...
You can't let it boil.
...that are unkind.
You annihilate the cheese if you let the cream or milk or whatever you're making a cheese sauce. You cannot do that to the cheese. You have to be gentle. You have to do low heat. That's the whole thing. Is
when you that the basic cheese sauce that you see, there are things that we call different names for cheese sauce in the States. The one that is most typical, at least in the north of Italy, for pasta, is a fonduta, and a fonduta is cream with kind of whatever cheese you have around.
Right.
The most famous ones are from. They use a lot of fontina. They're from the Valdosta, from up in that same direction.
Which is an incredible
great
melting
cheese.
Yeah, exactly. So it's
and you'll see little,
it's perfect.
You'll see them where they put some goat in as well, and so. Mm-hmm. But the other ones are kind of a garnish. Fontina is the base.
Yeah. And, I also think Taleggio too. I mean, that's another good melting.
Can
one.
Do well. You got to watch the rind.
Right. Oh well, I cut that off. I cut the rind off.
But oh, yeah, Taleggio.
That's I know. It's so good.
Oh, Taleggio. Oh, I have romantic goodness. Feelings about Taleggio.
But yeah, when you do something like that, you heat up the cream first, and season it. Get it done. You know, have the cream ready to go. If that's what you're doing, you're just making a cream sauce, and then on very low heat, your cream's already hot. Just gently whisk in small pieces of that beautiful melting cheese and then serve it.
If you want to heat it back up correctly, if you make it and you have leftover and you want to heat it back up correctly, use a double boiler, for God's sake.
Yeah, that is, I agree.
Otherwise, you're going to scorch it and it's going to ruin the flavor of the entire thing.
Right. You just have to be gentle. It is probably one of the most gentle things besides, you know, maybe making hollandaise or something or beurre blanc, you know, that you just have to be super careful and then everything will be amazing.
It takes some touch and some restraint, no question. Mm-hmm. Pasta with fonduta, like simple gnocchi or gnocchetti, a little tiny gnocchi with fonduta and any little garnish. You know, it could be toasted pistachios or you name it. Pancetta, sorry.
Oof.
I didn't mean not to throw in pork or butter into a dish. Cindy. Yeah, pancettas, a little crispy pancetta decorated on
so
that guy.
So pretty. Yeah. Little sage.
And honestly, that leaning towards goat in that fonduta, you know, fontina base, and leaning towards goat to give it a little tang.
Yeah, it's nice. Makes it more interesting. Yeah. I mean, after all, you are adding it to cream. So, yeah, you need some balance. That's great. Yeah. Well, yeah, and I think, you know, when you have something like, you know, that explains how you would add cheese to make a cream sauce. If you're working with something like lasagna, you know, it's going to be protected, basically, you know, because the pasta is going to protect it. So. It's not going to be, you're not going to hurt the cheese
well,
at 350
also, frankly,
degrees.
You're baking it.
It's a different situation.
It's ricotta as well. You know, it's going to, part of what keeps the lasagna moist is that ricotta. So, man, I'm still thinking about the raclette.
Oh, I know.
The elegant cheese fries. That's all we have time for today on Formula Wolf on Food & Wine. If you want to listen to this episode or any one of our others, please go to the WYPR website, wypr.org. Look for the Foreman Wolf page, and there's a full menu of goodies right there. If you want to correspond with us via email, it's foremanwolf@wypr.org. To follow Chef Cindy Wolf on social media,
you can follow me as Chef Wolf on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook.
My Instagram is The Real Tony Foreman. And thanks for listening.
Happy Sunday.